Good morning, everyone.
I'd like to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Have the record reflect that it is 9:03 a.m. on Monday, April 22nd, 2024. Present today, we have Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Representative Crome, Representative Ortiz, Representative Kronk, Co-Chair Johnson, myself, Co-Chair Edgman. We have just been joined by Representative Josephson. Before we start the meeting, please mute your cell phones. I should start by saying that Representative Foster is got some district business, so he'll be gone for a couple of days, and asked if I might pinch hit for him while he's gone. So the business before the committee this morning is three bills, and we have about an hour, sort of a hard stop, with the floor at 10:30, and then caucus before that. We'd like to begin the meeting by hearing House Bill 116, Restorative Justice Appropriations. And the plan is to introduce two new fiscal notes. And since there were no amendments, move the bill out if it's the will of the committee. Then after that, we'll hear House Bill 144, Repeal Education Tax Credit Sunset by Representative Ruppridge. I see his staff is here. And then if it's the will of the committee, move that bill out as well. Finally, we will have an introductory hearing on House Bill 45, which is the PFD contributions to the general fund and permanent fund. This is the first hearing on the bill, so we'll have a brief sort of introductory hearing and set that aside for future action. So, beginning with House Bill 116, Restorative Justice Appropriations, I'd like to ask the sponsor, Representative Cologne, and her staff, Edwin Morledge, to please come to the table. Please, if you would, put yourselves on the record and provide a brief recap on the bill and what it proposes to do.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. My name is Julie Colomb. I'm representative for House District 11.
And my name is Edra Morledge, staff to Julie Colomb, Representative Julie Colomb.
So I'll just do a brief recap since we've heard the bill a couple of times. So House Bill 116 reorganizes the percentages of the funds that pass through the restorative justice account that fund nonprofit organizations through the Council of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault for services for victims in domestic violence and sexual assault programs. This legislation changes the share of the funds that are currently set out, reversing the share for CDBSA and the Department of Corrections.
Okay, given that this is the bill's third hearing, it's been before the committee a couple of times, you should be fairly familiar with it, but any additional questions or comments? Thank you, Representative Colomb and Ms. Morledge. Given that there are two new fiscal notes to replace the ones that were originally submitted by the departments, members should have the new fiscal notes in their bill packets. And given that, if I could have Brody Anderson from Representative Foster's office please come to the table and give us a walkthrough on the fiscal notes.
My apologies if you heard that was my phone. For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. I'm coming before the committee today to review two House Finance fiscal notes, ONB component 2952 for the Department of Corrections, and fiscal note OMB component 521 for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We will go ahead and start with the OMB component 2952 for the Department of Corrections, appropriation, health and rehabilitation services, allocation, physical health care. In the bill, the policy that was discussed was switching around and creating different percentages of appropriation of restorative justice funds. And so these fiscal notes reflect the policy that's reflected in the bill. You'll notice that about halfway through the page, we have fund sources. First thing you'll see is that restorative justice fund 1171 has a decrement of $7,534,200 for the FY25 budget. That is the amount that Legislative Finance has confirmed is the amount that is available and would be appropriated for this year. There is then a fund source swap to UGF for that corresponding equal amount. And then on the outgoing years, the restorative justice money is considered indeterminate, not knowing how much. This assumes the 3% allocation for DOC, which is what HB 116 allows, a 1 to 3%. So this would be the max allowable amount. Also, you'll notice that for the UGF, general fund unrestricted, the FY25 appropriation replaces the restorative justice funds, and then it also allows the department time to transition to a lower allocation of restorative justice funds moving forward in the outgoing years. That is OMB component number 2952. The next one we would review is OMB component 521. And what you see there, I'll start once again in the middle of the page. Under fund sources, you see restorative justice account number 1171 for an increase of $7,534,200. That is the amount transferred out from corrections. And because this is a transfer in, or money that is now being allocated in the operating expenditures, we have to designate how they're going to spend that new funds. And you'll notice that under the grants and benefits line above it, you'll see that same $7.5 million now being available in grants and benefits. This is in line with the current language in HB 116, which is allocating 79% of the allowable 79% to 88% now going available for victims in the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Mr. Co-Chair, that summarizes the two fiscal notes.
Questions, Representative Josephson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brody, I want to have a Finance 101 moment with you. And so here's the 101 elementary question. These documents will get a stamp if part of the motion is to move the bill with the fiscal notes that says approved H fine or something like that. And then these dollars are not in the operating budget, but the conference committee will look at these fiscal notes, and if they adopt them, they may as well be effectively part of the operating budget. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, that is correct. These fiscal notes will first replace the existing fiscal notes in your packets. When you go to the floor, these will be the approved fiscal notes that leave this committee. Then fast forward to the end of conference committee, there is a fiscal note package that is negotiated at conference committee. Conference committee will have the ability to reconcile fiscal notes to the actual operating budget component, so things could change, but in the end, the fiscal notes after conference committee approval would then enforce whatever funding has been allocated for FY25.
Additional questions, Co-Chair Johnson?
Thank you. So, first of all, are we supposed to have three fiscal notes or just two?
Through the chair, Representative, just two.
Just two, okay. Thank you. And through the chair, we had our fiscal notes before showed a decrement to Department of Corrections. Is that still, in fact, the way this funding is?
No, excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, right now corrections will be essentially held harmless with no cuts visible for FY25. That is the fund source swap you see between the restorative justice and the UGF. In the outgoing years, I will point out that notice that there is no UGF designated in 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30. That means essentially the DOC fiscal note, if I could be as bold as to summarize, it would create almost an OTI where we're only funding that $7.5 million FY25, and then next year in FY26, the Department of Corrections would be required to come and ask for an increment to replace that UGF for the following years. So it doesn't dump it into the base, as a lot of people sometimes refer to it. This will not, the 7.5 million will not enter the base in perpetuity until they ask for it next year.
So the amount that comes from a permanent fund dividend, so I just want to walk through how I remember all of the path through the chair, how this came to be, is at some point, and I'm trying to remember exactly what year, there was a desire to have the incarcerated members' permanent funds go to the state to provide for their incarceration. And it seems like, I don't have any notes in front of me, but I want to say about 2018 or 20, that percentage, it was renamed a restorative justice account. A small percent, I think there was three different amounts, three different sections that it was sectioned off to. It still, most of it went to, just kind of offsets the cost of having people incarcerated, but it was renamed the restorative justice account at that point. I guess what I'm wondering is, I just don't want this to happen again because, Department of Corrections has gotten more money and it's in the restorative justice account. And we can, maybe this can be taken up at a later committee, but I just want to make note that it was originally set up to offset the state's, the cost of incarceration. It wasn't set up to, benefit prisoners exactly. It was to just knowing that the state was sending out a PFD check, that would go back to the state. So I just want to make sure that, on the record that we make note that that's what this account was originally established for. And then it was a name change, and now we're taking, a large portion of the account, even though it was originally established to offset costs to the state. And so it is a significant fiscal note.
Representative Flum, did you want to make any comments to that effect?
Sure, a couple of things. Thank you, Chair Edgman, through the chair to Rep. Johnson. So 1988 was when the fund was established. 2018 was when there was a policy change where it, I wasn't here then, but that there was an intent that it would be going towards more to restoring victims than offsetting the corrections cost. The percentages laid out at that time still favored the corrections department. So this is just another step in trying to fulfill the policy change that happened in 2018 to restore victims. I've had a lot of people come in, they're concerned about victims not getting restitution, not getting restoration. This is one vehicle that can help stabilize what we're doing with victims. Also, one of the things that I wanted to do this, and you'll see the intent language in the bill, is that in statute, CVSA is required to put together a prevention program, and they don't have the money to do that. And so this is an intent to not only help victims, but do a lot more education and preventative programs with the money. I would also add that we did put $3.7 million in for CDBSA, and so when it comes to conference committee, I suspect there might be a balance there that it won't be the full seven, that whatever shakes out. But I think it's an important policy change going forward.
So we have a follow-up, co-chair. So we have Representative Galvin, and I see Hannah, Representative Works. And I think after that, we're going to move on to final action on the bill. We'll keep an eye on the clock. Representative Galvin.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Edgman. I just wanted to, two things. Firstly, thank you, Representative Colombe, for finding some way to ensure that victims are better supported. I know that it's a tough avenue to find it, and And I appreciate that perhaps the original intent may have been different than where we are with these funds, but we certainly need to find some common ground where we're better protecting victims, and I appreciate your work. I do support this. I do have a question with regard to the fund in general. It's a little confusing to me. This is the act takes place, and perhaps Brody might be the one through the chair if I may ask this question about the fund.
Sponsor knows.
Thank you. The act is effective on July 1st, 2024. And my question is about, my understanding is the fund is filled from PFD dollars. And I presume that happens in maybe October-ish. I'm not sure. So help me to understand then, are we talking about last year's PFD dollars then that will be rolled into the fund come July 1st? And how that shakes out, just so that we're clear on whether or not this involves FY24, FY25. I assume it's just 25, given that this says it's effective on the July 1st, 24. But it's confusing to me as to when and what dollars then get dropped into this effective bill. Thanks.
This is Edra Morledge, staff to Representative Colomb. Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Yes, these are the funds from the permanent fund dividend from last year.
Thank you.
So translation, there's a year lag time, as I recall, right? So the PFD from calendar year 2023 goes into effect essentially in the fiscal year that starts in July 1st, in calendar year 24.
Right.
So correct. So 1 year late. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Colomb. I also share the previous speaker's praise for this particular bill. I'll be supportive of it. I just want to make sure I clearly understand the fiscal implications here. In the first year, is it correct to say that in the first year of this bill enactment, while the intent of the bill, and I support the intent of the bill, for more resources, PFD resources going towards victims, the real fiscal impact of the bill, at least in the first year, will, that money will just be replaced by general fund money. Is that correct? In other words, there won't be any immediate impact on corrections. They'll have that same amount of money that they would have under the original statute. They'll have the same amount of money. It's just going to be coming from the general fund. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that is correct. And essentially, Department of Corrections will be held harmless for FY25.
Thank you.
Very good. That's the end of the comments or questions for the committee. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. There were no amendments submitted for this bill. So we're at the point where if there is no further committee discussion on the bill, I would ask the co-chair to make a motion, if she would please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 144-33-LS-0309-B. Is that back at the right?
It's House Bill 116.
116. Okay. Thank you. All right. Thank you. I move House Bill 116-33-LS-0602-B from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Not seeing or hearing any, so moved. House Bill 116 passed the House Finance Committee. We'll take a very brief at ease to sign the documents. The committee come back to order. Next item of business is House Bill 144, Repeal Education Tax Credit Sunset. It comes before the committee to have its second hearing. And if I can have Representative Ruffridge and staff Bud Sexton, please come to the table. Give us a brief recap of the bill. Put yourself on the record as you are about to.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of House Finance. My name is Justin Ruffridge, representative from District 7. Thank you again for the opportunity to reintroduce you to House Bill 144. This is a relatively simple bill repealing the sunset, which is coming up at the end of this year. And there is a need to hopefully continue that program. This is a program where organizations or corporations, businesses can give dollars to educational institutions and then receive a tax credit. It has been well utilized, I think, since the late 80s, 1987 to be sure, I think, and has been reauthorized ever since. I just personally have a slight dislike for sunsets just in general for programs that are working, and I think it would be great to just repeal that sunset and move on with a program that is working. So that is a brief introduction to this bill, and I don't know if my staff had anything they wanted to add to that. Mr. Sexton.
For the record, Bud Sexton, staff to Representative Ruffridge. Nothing further to add at this point unless you have any questions.
Questions, committee members, comments? Co-chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is, I could ask the general question as to why you just dislike sunsets in general. I kind of like sunset in general, but and I'm not necessarily saying that this program shouldn't be sunsetted, but I think originally when it was set up, there must have been a reason that people said we want to have our eyes on it ever so often. And I would just like to kind of get your sense on why you think that's different now and if it was just a matter of making sure that the program's working or what is it that you think has changed from the original intent?
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Ruffridge, for the record. Also for the record, I love sunsets, but the sunsets outside. Bill sunsets and legislative sunsets I do dislike, so I just want to make sure that I clarify that for the record. This bill, I do see that there is a need for sunsets in periodic language. For a new bill, a new piece of legislation, let's see how this works, and if it is great, we'll extend it. If not, we'll let it go. But this bill this program has been in place for almost 40 years, and I think there is a lack of stability sometimes that comes with continuing to bring forward pieces of legislation that make alterations to a program, particularly a program as relatively simple as a tax credit for education. Every time that this bill has come forward for a sunset, there has been alterations to the structure of the credit, which does lead to, in some cases, confusion as to what version of this program we're operating under. And so I think that in the interest of stability, of saying this is a state in which if a person or an entity wants to donate money to an educational institution, there is an opportunity to receive a credit, and here is the credit, and have that move forward without some of that instability. I think that is sort of my dislike of the sunset in this case. It has been perpetually sunsetted for almost 40 years now, and the program has always been moved forward, but it's always had slight alterations to either the dollar amounts, the percentages of the credit that was available, and I think that that has added to just a sense of instability to the program itself.
Thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. through the chair, Representative, I wanted to bring up the one list that you gave in the packet that says frequently asked questions. And just because we've been hearing lots about the ruling last week, I just thought I would ask if there is anything relevant to that discussion. I appreciate that we're talking about tax credits as opposed to appropriations, which may be thought of differently, but I would like to hear your thoughts on that and whether you've checked in with Ledge Legal about that, because the ruling related to education seemed to take out pretty significant portions of statutes related to correspondence funding and things like that. And I'm not sure if some of these organizations may be utilizing some of the same systemic approaches and how funds are passed through. But it does say here on our list of, I think it's, these are examples of ways that dollars are spent with the program that you're referring to. And through the tax credit program, it does list nonprofit agencies for public schools, for example, lots of descriptions around nonprofit. And I know that there can be private nonprofit institutions that are religious. It doesn't say that specifically in here, though, and I just thought I would ask so that you could help us clarify, given that the seems like the last ruling was referring to anything related to religious institutions.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Galvin. I want to be really careful, and I think that my response may sound slightly irritated. I'm not. So I just want to put that out there. But I think the ruling was made last week or almost it was last week. Really actually has nothing to do with this program whatsoever. And I want to be careful that we don't conflate what may have been, a situation that was obviously moving forward in a way that was unconstitutional, was ruled unconstitutional. But that's because it took some big steps forward to say that public money could be used in some cases for private or religious instruction. And actually, if you read the statute that was ultimately ruled against, it sort of had some incongruencies, I guess would be the right terminology. So... But that had to do with dollars that were state dollars that were then appropriated for a specific purpose and then went through the process of not following, I guess, what our constitutional language would imply. Now, that being said, and I understand why you're asking the question, let's take it a step back for a second and say if any of the members of this body donated dollars to their church, would they apply for a credit on their taxes? The answer to that is yes, because a tax credit is not the same as a legislative body appropriating funds for a specific purpose, and then that purpose being granted a credit. They're wildly different. And I think the United States tax code shows that. I think our tax code, obviously this has been in place for a long time, has shown that. And I do want to be careful that we're not bringing up an issue that I think is actually very separate. And I do understand, the concerns and making sure that we are applying public dollars correctly. But this is, again, this is a donation being made with private dollars and then the state saying thank you for that donation with your private money. And we will not tax you for that private money that you've donated.
And then just to clarify, the money goes through the normal appropriation process. If it's a university, it goes through that sort of appropriation in the budget. If it's a school district, it goes through the K-12 formula. It gets dispersed to all public schools, which essentially would cover public neighborhood schools, charter schools, correspondence schools. And if it is a technical training school, thusly is so. Is that your understanding?
Through the chair, to the chair, no, actually, this program would be, there is no appropriations occurring with this at all. If you look at the fiscal note, it is essentially saying there will just be a reduction in revenue to the state in the dollar amounts that you are allowing an entity to not pay tax for. So there is no appropriation, actually.
The proceeds go directly to the beneficiary?
So essentially, Mr. Chair, if you owned a company and that company made a donation directly to the institution of your choice, then you would apply to the state Department of Revenue and say, I would like to not have a bill that is a certain level. I'd like it to be reduced. And pay less taxes.
Thank you. And I thank you for the refresher on that.
If I may have a follow-up to that question. So thank you, through the chair. Real quickly, so I've received some emails of folks who are concerned, and so that's why I asked the question. I appreciate you helping to frame this conversation a bit more generally and at the 10,000-foot level. So just to be clear, my understanding is corporations who do have taxes, and it's only those. So, for example, it would be mining license tax, fisheries, oil and gas, and maybe one or two others. And those who pay that tax typically to our Department of Revenue, if they choose instead to make a partial donation, and there are, as I understand it, there are limits on how much they can put in. And we've raised that limit, I believe, this year or this group has, I don't know if it's passed through the Senate yet, but we've raised it, I believe, to $3 million roughly. It used to be another amount, $1 million. Anyway, just to make sure I'm clear on this, then what happens is if they are going to pay taxes of up to that amount, they may then submit proof that they have given to any number of these organizations and then receive a lower tax bill than they would normally spend. So we're calling that a tax credit. Yes, than they would normally give to the state government.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that's correct.
Great. I just wanted to make sure that. So that's why I think some of my constituents have written in, because they want to understand that it means less revenue to the general fund for the state of Alaska to spend. But it does also mean that these organizations are directly supported through private entities who choose to support them. Correct?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Not seeing any additional questions. Representative Joseph.
Well, just a comment that I'm not so sure that it's that. I don't want to hold the bill up, and I'm not going to hold the bill up. But I'm not so sure it's so simple. I suspect if you paid me a handsome hourly rate, I could write a 50-page brief about this, citing all sorts of authority one way or the other. One thing I do know is that, generally speaking, when the audience is a post-18-year-old audience, the courts have less anxiety. That I know. And that's why, for example, the Alaska Bible College is more acceptable than Lumen Christi in Anchorage, for example. But I think that we should, there's no problem that I know of in lifting the sunset. I just don't think that that the question, the legal question, is so clear. That's all.
Fair enough. I think two very excellent lines of questioning on the bill and commentaries as well. Representative Ruffridge, did you want to close things out?
Well, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly appreciate the opportunity to present the bill again, and certainly appreciate support. Happy to talk about some of these questions, Representative Josephson, offline, if you want to continue that that discussion. And I guess I will say I'm pretty sure for that handsome hourly rate, we could write 50-page briefs about just about anything. That is unfortunately the nature of the world that we're in. But this program has been well supported. It has existed for many, many years without any sort of such challenges. And I think it would be in our best interest and in the best interest of those educational institutions in the state that are supported through this program, namely the University of Alaska, does receive quite a large benefit from this to continue this program.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. Just quickly to the sponsor through the chair, is there a companion bill on the other side, and is it meeting it somewhere soon, or is this bill the only one?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there is a companion bill on the other side, it's got a slightly different, it actually sort of is the proof of the point I was making earlier. They make some changes to some of the dollar amounts, and it's a little bit more, I think, significant than just a simple repeal of the sunset. But I think Mr. Sexton has a couple of other items to add.
Yeah, through the chair, Bud Sexton staff to represent a reference. It's not a true companion. That one does extend the sunset, and ours is a repeal. Additionally, as Representative Rufford mentioned, they do make changes, the increases to the amount of deduction levels, and the cap as well is increased. With this bill that we're proposing, we would keep the levels as is, that is at current. And as Representative Galvin did allude to a little bit, I think you were alluding to the other bodies bill, which does raise those amounts. So the current amounts were established in 2018 under House Bill 223. And since from 218 down, it lowered the amount of deductions to where it is currently, which is around the 50% level and with a $1 million cap. So in light of our fiscal situation, our proposal is to keep the levels as is to make sure it's a reasonable impact and a balanced approach to regarding our fiscal situation.
One follow-up.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. There probably was a sunset audit. What was their recommended extension of length of time for renewing the bill?
Through the record, through the chair to Representative Hannon, I don't recall specifically. I believe it's either a 4 or 6 year. We do have if you would like, I know we have a representative from UA here who could probably answer that question if you would like.
Yeah, I'm looking to see what the Senate companion and what the ledge audit recommendation was, whether their recommendation was to fully remove a sunset or perpetuate one at some length of time.
Well, I think it's fair to say that the audit did not recommend in perpetuity, because I've yet to see an audit that recommends that. I guess I have seen that before. It's the exception and not the rule. But I will say that, for the record, it's at least one member of the committee. I share Representative Ruffridge's line of thinking in terms of extending the bill and just knowing the amount of time and effort and actually cost involved in these things. And knowing, as you pointed out, Representative Hannon, that there is the ability to audit these programs and make subsequent changes without having to, you know, to go through the whole reauthorization of a program that really becomes to be a sort of a rote exercise, you know, 4, 6, 3, whatever it might be. But if you desire, we can get the individual online.
I, much like Representative Josephson, I'm not interested in holding up the bill, but I continue to have an interest in making sure that we come back and revisit bills going forward. So completely suspending the sunset gives me a little concern, but the underlying premise of the bill I'm very supportive of, so I'll be satisfied with having raised the questions and not holding it up another day.
Okay. Thank you. Not seeing any additional hands raised around the committee table. I'd like to thank you, Representative Ruffridge and your staff, Mr. Sexton. Next, we've got Director Lori Wingheyer online as opposed to in the room. I don't see her in the room. But if you might put yourself on the record, Ms. Wingheyer, and go through the two fiscal notes, if you would, please, or at least the one fiscal, pardon me. Ms. Winghire, are you on the phone? We do not have. We'll take a very brief at ease here. Committee, please come back to order. We decided on a plan B in terms of the fiscal notes, and that is in the absence of Ms. Winghire, at least momentarily here, have Mr. Anderson come to the table and walk the committee through the fiscal note. And if there's further detailed questions, we will decide what to do at that point.
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Neil Foster. Today I will be presenting the fiscal note for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, appropriation insurance, allocation insurance operations, OMB component 354. This fiscal note reflects that there is no significant changes on the first page. In the analysis, insurance operations submitted a fiscal note because there is the insurance premium tax is a collectible tax that insurance companies need to pay. And because of the education tax credits, these tax credits would be eligible to be used against any sort of liability that a company might have occurred in their insurance premium tax liability. It looks like the credit is claimed against, so they don't, the insurance sharp decline in credits being claimed, they have a breakdown in their last paragraph about how much has been claimed against education tax credits in that last paragraph.
Co-Chair Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I wanted to go to the other fiscal note that we have here, the other, it's from the department, DCCED, and it's an information question. So it's a zero fiscal note, but is that because the DCCED does not administer a grant program for this? Because this is like a direct payment to institutions, so it doesn't really flow through the through a grant program. Would that be the reason? This is one of the reasons. I mean, I see some other things here, but
I will. Through the chair, representative, I will take a stab at it the best I can, and I will make apologies if I get this wrong. But tax credits are managed by the Department of Revenue under the tax division, and they'll refer to their fiscal note in the next fiscal note review. But because fiscal notes don't always reflect lost revenue, this would be considered something that could potentially be seen as lost revenue for the tax credit amount being held against the liability of that insurance premium tax. They say, though, that therefore, in anticipation, no loss in revenue due to the repeal So, excuse me, they, if this is repealed and not passed, they would have no loss in revenue. So the idea is just reflecting that revenue is lost when tax credits are claimed against tax liability. That's.
I see the bill sponsor staff back there, and I don't know. I think Mr. Anderson covered it well enough. But if you want to, but you or the bill sponsor want to come forward and sort of elaborate on that, please do. We're sort of, I don't want to use the word improvising here, but we're at a plan B here without having our department expert here on the phone. But to address that question, we go to Representative Gelman. Or not the question, but just to elaborate further, if you would, for a moment.
Yeah, for the record, Bud Sexton, staff to Representative Ruffridge through the chair. So, as Mr. Anderson spoke to, this being a tax credit program, so there is not any payments that go out to any of these entities. They are simply, it is the donations to these educational institutions, and as such, the donation is able to receive a tax credit through this program. So as Mr. Anderson mentioned, it is a reduction in revenue to the state. So if you look at one of the, so let's say for the year 2023, total contributions were just over $5.4 million. And then the credits claimed, because we're at the 50% threshold currently, so about $2.7 million were credits claimed, so it's a loss of revenue to the state of that amount.
Ready, Representative Gelman.
Thank you, and I appreciate that this bill is very simple. As it turns out, it really is just about the sunset cap period. I just wanted to comment so that the public also appreciates that it's not just the Senate bill on the other side that has a different cap or sunset date, but also there's another bill that this body has worked through and already supported, HB 89 child care. And HB 89 child care, that bill, just so that we're all aware, it also changes the cap dollar that one could put into these organizations that we've talked about today, the educational organizations, along with childcare organizations. So that cap has been will have been changed if the Senate also passes that. In that case, these fiscal notes would be different. So I just wanted to make sure that we're aware of that. It's fine. I'm not suggesting that we don't pass this. I just wanted us to be aware that that would potentially significantly change the fiscal note. This one doesn't, because it's not making any other changes around the cap of what one can use and defer their own tax bill, which would be direct revenue to the Department of Revenue. So I just wanted to clarify as I've been looking into both bills. Thank you.
Good clarification. Appreciate that. Not seeing any additional comments or questions from the committee members. Let's see where we. Mr. Anderson, do I need to get further input on the fiscal notes?
I do. Excuse me, through the representative. I do believe Trent Williams, the acting director, is online to walk the committee through the tax division, which is where the substantial part of the lost revenue is reflected.
Mr. Williams, can you hear us?
Yes, Chair Hedgeman. This is, and members of the committee, this is Michael Williams, Acting Deputy Tax Director, Alaska Department of Revenue.
Can you put yourself on the record and walk us through the fiscal note, please?
Certainly. Chair Hedgeman and members of the committee, again, for the record, Michael Williams, Acting Deputy Tax Director, Alaska Department of Revenue. The fiscal note is, the background on the education credit is that it is the credit for qualifying contributions to Alaska universities and accredited nonprofit Alaska two-year, four-year colleges for facilities, direct instruction, research, and educational support purposes. Donations to a school or school district or state-operated or nonprofit-operated technical and training school for vocational educational purposes, programs and facilities, and donations for Alaska Native cultural heritage programs for public school staff and students, and a facility in the state that qualifies as a coastal ecosystem learning center under the Coastal American Partnership. The credit is available to be claimed against the insurance premiums tax, title insurance premiums, corporate income tax, oil and gas production tax, oil and gas property tax, mining license tax, fisheries business tax, and fishery resource landing tax. The credit for any one taxpayer cannot exceed $1 million annually across all tax types, and the credit is currently scheduled to sunset January 1, 2025. This bill would repeal that sunset provision. The change in revenues reported here only include those eligible programs administered by the Department of Revenue, and the bill's fiscal impacts from eliminating the current repeal provision beyond 2025. And so you'll see on the first page, so fiscal January 1, 2025 is halfway into fiscal 25, so that's an estimated $1.5 million fiscal impact, and then the outgoing years based on historical credit claims year over year would be about a little over $3 million, $3.1 million year over year in foregone revenue for contributions that are claimed for the education tax credit. There is no implementation cost or administration cost for the Department of Revenues other than just absorbing it under current operating expenses. There's no grant process. These contributions go directly from a private corporation to the eligible entity or programs listed in the statute. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Yeah, I think I would, and our time is pretty brief here, but maybe if you could sort of generalize, and I think the bill sponsor talked about the bulk of the receipts or the proceeds going to the university. Can you sort of put it in that sort of fashion?
Certainly, Chair Edgman and members of the committee, the calendar year 23 education credits, I believe that Mr. Sexton for Representative Ruffridge's office is referred to. Total contributions for the calendar year were $5.4 million, and of that contributions, there was roughly $3.4 million going to the University of Alaska system, just shy of $1 million going to Alaska Pacific University, and then about $750,000 going to secondary schools, meaning K through 12 or school districts or the VOTEC eligible institutions, and then roughly $300,000 to other eligible organizations like the Alaska Native Heritage Program. And so that $5.4 million in contributions translated to $2.7 million in tax credits.
Any additional comments or questions from committee members? Not seeing any.
Just real quickly, if I might.
Representative Josephson.
When we go to places like the Performing Arts Center and see large contributions from Conoco, are those... those are different types of tax credits?
Through the chair to the representative, I'm not aware that is eligible for a credit. That's not on the list of eligible contributions under the current statute.
Okay, thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I just have one question. And I see that there's contribution for equipment or... could even be housing, it looks like. Do these items, not cash, but items, do they have, you have to take them? Who evaluates those? I mean, as far as, you know, maybe getting a white elephant piece of property.
Through the chair of the representative, so contributions of equipment in order to be eligible have to meet the same standard as a charitable contribution would under the Internal Revenue Code, and contributions of equipment over a certain dollar value require, or land, would require to have an official appraisal to substantiate the value taken for that contribution.
Thank you. And through the chair, so does the Department of Revenue do that, or who does that? Who does that appraisal?
Again, through the chair to the representative. Normally, those appraisals, again, to qualify for charitable contribution, there's certain documentation that the donor is required to maintain. And if on audit we were to look at a piece of equipment or land that had been contributed, we would request the evaluation to support the substantiate the value of that donation.
All right, thank you.
All right, seeing no additional questions or comments, we'd like to thank the gentleman at the table as well as Mr. Williams for the discussion on the fiscal notes. Madam Co-Chair, not seeing any additional discussion on the bill itself.
I would like to move House Bill 14433-LS0654-A from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Not seeing any objections, so moved. So House Bill 144 has passed the Finance Committee. Representative Prox, we'll keep the committee going here while we get the bill document passed around. We'll sign that. If you could come forward with your bill, I think you can introduce pretty quickly. Representative Prox, anytime you want to begin, put yourself on record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is Mike Prox, Representative Mike Prox. I represent District 33. And thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 45, an act relating to contributions from permanent fund dividends to the general fund and permanent fund. House Bill 45 would add a button to the electronic PFD application process to give Alaskans the choice of donating all or a portion of their permanent fund dividend directly to the state's general fund. Participants can donate in increments of up to 10%, in increments of 10% up to the full amount of PFD. Currently, in order to return your PFD to the states, to the state, Alaskans must apply for the dividend, receive their dividend, and return it through the U.S. mail. Passage of this bill will greatly facilitate Alaskans' ability to donate their PFD to the state's general fund. In this previous version of this was introduced in the 32nd legislature as House Bill 158, was amended in the House in this legislature, and it enjoyed 22 co-sponsors that year. It was reintroduced this year and came out of the House Finance in the House Ways and Means, as it came out of the House Finance last year. In the House Ways and Means Committee this year, it was amended by making some minor changes that would make the implementation of this bill go more smoothly. Now, there are numerous reasons why a person might choose to give some or all of their dividend back to the state, but Alaskans deserve to have the option of doing this in a simple and efficient manner. House Bill 45 would give them that option, which is why I'm asking for your support. And I guess we'd be happy to go through the sectional if you wish or answer questions. Either way, it's up to you.
Mr. Nye, did you have any comments to add to the sponsor? Just
for the record, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. I don't have any comments, just if I can read the explanation of changes in sectional if you so wish.
We can do that rather quickly because the bill is pretty pretty straightforward. So if you might, please.
I lost my thing. Once again, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. This is the sectional explanation of changes, version A to B. And section one in the House Ways and Means Committee, we added a new section that amends AS 43-2355 for the purpose of establishing the following priority order for contributions. The education raffle would be number one, and then pick, click, give would be number two, and Alaska general fund donations would be number three. In section two, this was previously section one in version A of the bill, and it was renumbered to be section two. The following words were deleted in the transition from A to B. A contribution to the state general fund or the principal of the permanent fund may be $25 or more in increments up to $25 up to the total amount of the permanent fund dividend that the applicant is entitled to receive. And we change this to increments of 10% up to the total amount of the PFD. On page 3, lines 18 through 20, we inserted a contribution to the state general fund or the principal. Oh, that was the 10% increment. Also, the following words were deleted, which the electronic application must include notice that 7% of the money contributed to the state general fund or the principal of the permanent fund will be used for administrative costs incurred in implementing this subsection, and that the money from the dividend fund will not be used for that purpose. Finally, on page 3, line 26 through 28, the following words were inserted. Money from a contribution under this section, under the subsection, or from the dividend fund may not be used for implementing this subsection.
All right. Well, we have the bill on the record, and the plan would be to come back at a later date and have additional hearings on the bill. Representative Foster will, of course, have the gavel at that point. Is there any questions or comments on our way out of the meeting today? Thank you, Representative Prox, for the presentation. I presume no concluding comments.
Just if you do have questions or suggested amendments, if you could please get with me beforehand so we can expedite the hearing process.
Thank you. Our next regularly scheduled House Finance Committee meeting will be this afternoon at 1:30 p.m. We'll hear Senate Bill 187, the capital budget, a fiscal update presentation from the Legislative Finance Division. And with that, and seeing no further business to come before the committee at 10:05 a.m., we are adjourned.